5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's another special.
Woo-hoo!
Today's conversation is with Bruce Daisley. He's European VP, that's Vice President for Twitter. And he also hosts his own podcast, which is called, it's apparently the UK's number one business podcast. It's called Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. But he's written this book, The Joy of Work, 30 Ways to Fix Your Work Culture and Fall in Love with Your Job Again. I've read the book, and it's an interesting book. It's all based on science, basically, on how to improve your workplace. So there's there's differing categories, but it's not for employers, it's for employees as well. We also talked to him a lot about Twitter.
Yeah, he's fascinating.
He's a good guy, isn't he?
He's really, really lovely fella, really interesting, funny, and also tells a story that makes you sweat on the spot.
At the end.
Yeah, I could feel myself. We've all done it, but it was quite a...
Yeah. Oh. So I've listened to a few of his podcasts, and they're good. He speaks to experts all about how to improve the workplace. So he's become a real expert at it, and that's why he's written that book. He's got some great stats about how stressed you potentially are and how unsatisfied you are, and then he's got some great solutions for how to sort it out. But I've got some interesting news for you, Mark. First podcast of the year.
Go on.
Is it the first podcast? First we've recorded.
First we've recorded of the year.
We've gone and got ourselves a sponsor.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm excited about this sponsor because it's a product that
I
absolutely love. It is Quokka, or I think as there's the hot water taps, or as I think they pronounce it in the Netherlands, Quokka, I think.
Right.
I should have probably investigated
Quokka?
This.
Quokka.
So I've got to do a read like they do on those American podcasts.
Are we like a proper podcast?
Yeah.
Are we all grown up?
Yeah, we are. So this is very exciting stuff. As I say, though, it's good that it's a product we like. So here we go. The Dear Lovejoy podcast is sponsored by Quokka. The tap that does it all. 100 degree, boiling hot, cold, and filtered cold water. A true revolution. The new kitchen must have. Quokka, the tap that does it all. Immediately dispensing 100 degree boiling water. Tap on the worktop, tank underneath. 100% Dutch invention taking over the world. We need to get some facts next time we do the read on how they are taking over the world. I wonder how many countries they sell into, and I know it was invented in 1974 or something.
Was it?
Yeah, I think
that
so.
That long ago?
Yeah, like ages ago. We'll do some history on it eventually. But yeah, I wonder how they are taking over the world. You can choose between a separate boiling water tap with accompanying mixer tap or the Quokka Flex or Fusion. You can have a single tap for hot, cold, and boiling water. Ultra safe, super efficient, and available in a variety of different designs and finishes. Do you like my one, Mark?
I do. It's, what is it? Is it brushed? Is it brushed steel? Is that how you would?
Yeah, I don't know how you describe it. Yeah, it looks nice.
It's very nice.
I love them. Life changing. As I always say, it's one of the greatest inventions ever. Just tea on tap and. But your vegetables just boil immediately. I love it. And if you thought that the Quokka was wasteful,
it's not a cooker.
It's not a cooker, it's a quicker. If you thought the quicker cooker was wasteful, think again. The patented high vacuum insulation ensures that quicker cooker standby usage is just 3 pence a day. For even more efficiency, choose a combi tank, a single, amazingly economical way to produce both hot and boiling water. No kitchen is complete without its quicker cooker. That's good, isn't it? Thank you very much for sponsoring us. And let's
they have
get
a
on
website.
With the. Yeah, I suppose they do, but I don't, don't have it. I'll give you the website at the end of the end of the podcast. Well, we nearly got it right. Anyway, thank you for sponsoring us, Quicker Cooker. Hey, let's get on with this podcast then. This is Bruce Daisley, live from my kitchen.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into dear Lovejoy.
Welcome, Bruce, to my kitchen. Thank you very much for coming in. All my guests, I buy a present. I bought you a nice bottle of wine.
That's magnificent. Thank you very much.
Do you drink?
I do, yeah. I enjoy a bit of wine.
Good. First thing I think we should discuss then is alcohol in the workplace then. We're going to talk about your book, The Joy of Work, in a minute. But there is a bit in the book about socializing.
Yeah,
there's quite a bit in the book about socializing with the workers. What have you done, any podcasts on alcohol in
I tried to, but it's sort of difficult to get people to do it. So is it worth sort of saying a preamble about what the book's about, or should we just go into the booze thing?
We'll get into that in a minute, because I'd have done it in the intro before I met you a bit, and then let's talk about
booze in the workplace. Actually, if you look at the science of it, it actually enhances cultures and it's a good thing. The only danger of booze in the workplace is if you become too reliant on it. So one of the challenges of pub cultures, you know, a lot of us have had a job where the happiness that we had in our job often extends to, should we just go and have a quick beer?
Yeah.
And the danger of building an entire culture on that is that you forget that these are some people not there. So it tends to become sort of quite cliquey. So there's two parts of it. Firstly, when it's just exclusively in the pub, and secondly, when it's after hours in the pub. And so what you tend to find is you don't miss that there's a few mums who've gone off to sort out their kids, or there's someone who's got responsibility for picking someone up or their family. If you look at the science about booze, there's not a bad thing about having booze and lubricating meetings, but you just got to be careful that you're not doing all of your work team building after hours.
It's interesting you say that mums, and I picked up that in the book, that there is, your book's full of studies as we know, but you picked up on the fact that a lot of mums can't join in with the social at the end of a work day.
It's not just mums, is it?
But yeah, that was the interesting thing, because you said mums there, and your book, the study says mums.
Yeah.
Mums are still... Women are still the ones who are having to go to work and then going back to look after the children. Predominantly, it's women still, isn't it? And I was thinking about that. I was thinking, because I'm a single parent, and I've been on this sort of crusade for a long time, sort of for sort of equality. I'm not sure what I think about it all now. But one of the things I've always thought is, and I discussed this with Harriet Harman, is I think employers should make it easier for both men and women to be looking after the family. And I think that's a really important issue. Yeah. Have you come across this in your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, it's not just men. The reason why I mention men, the reason why I mention women is that if you have a look, there's little things like long commutes correlate to unhappiness in women way more than in men. And it's principally because if you look into the data of that, like in London, for example, biggest commute in Europe, for 74 minutes, 75 minutes commute in on average. And it's the women who are unhappy. Generally, I think the men get into a niche of watching a bit of iPlayer or Netflix, or they download stuff. The women are just anxious about what jobs they've got to do. So it tends to correlate to women. But I agree with you, increasingly, Obviously, it's not just women, but you know, we need to get more balance.
I think we should be putting more pressure on employers to say, look, family comes first here. These people who have children, you've got to give them a bit of flexi time here. Everyone discusses it, but unless it's a job where you have to actually turn up to open up a shop at a certain time or close. If you should be like that. I remember talking to one of my friends, and his employers had just started this scheme where you could either come in early and then work late, or leave early and come in earlier, sort of thing, because you can do school runs. He was trying to encourage everybody to, because people were skipping all the time to go off and do the school runs.
Yeah, that's so. It. Well, and the guilt, you know, the average state of modern work is guilt.
Yeah.
You know, people are just perennially guilt, either guilty because they're leaving early to go and pick someone up, or they've got to do a responsibility, and so they're just constantly guilty.
Guilty, yeah.
I've seen some firms go to sort of core office hours. So they've said, you know, a lot of people say, I can't get anything done at work.
Yeah.
And so I love doing my emails before I go in the mornings. And I think a few firms, are sort of enlightened firms, are saying, okay, we want, there's definitely a benefit in people being in the office. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to say, you've got to be here from 11 till 4 or 11 till 3:30 every day. So you are getting... you are getting a few progressive firms trying to adapt it a bit, but it's not the norm yet.
The one thing when I was thinking about asking about alcohol was the Christmas party. I've always thought Christmas parties are a terrible idea. It's the one,
why?
Because it's the one time of year that you're supposed to all come together in this one big happy, but there's always a couple of people who then have to face work in the new year, who have either done or the next day or whenever it is, the next week, who've done something horrific, because alcohol's not a good bedfellow with work colleagues. I'm sorry, it's not. Every time I've gone to a work do in television, someone's told me what they think of me.
Right. What people forget as well is that the work party is work. Legally, it's classed as work. So whatever happens at the work party...
don't drink.
Counts as work.
Yeah, the things they say aren't complimentary. No, it's usually people say, you don't socialise with us enough, or you don't hang out with us enough. It's generally those sort of comments. Or you always look moody. I'm at work. I'm trying to think. I've got to do a 3-hour TV show. And it's always that kind of thing. But I always think, rather than give... a Christmas party, it'd probably be a better idea just to give them some money, because they'd probably be happier with that.
Yeah, you know what? A few people found, so here's what we know. People hanging together socially has a benefit. And one firm, I chatted to one company, and they'd realised that, look, it wasn't about booze, and by including booze, actually, I work at Twitter, and we've got, in our London office, we've got about 40 different nationalities. A lot of French people, a lot of sort of East European people, because they're engineers, they're developers. And a few of them came to me and said, what is it with the Brits? You can't get together unless you guys are hammered.
Yeah.
And they couldn't believe that we were drinking like on stag do's. The way that Brits, when they go on team nights out, they drink with real gusto. And so it just opened our eyes to the fact that, okay, so maybe this isn't something that happens everywhere. But what I met one firm, and they'd introduced this thing where they'd realised people getting together and having chat was beneficial. But they didn't want it to be too boozy. They have a little bit of booze.
Right.
And they called it Crisp Thursday. Yeah. And basically the receptionist had bought 3 tubes of Pringles, 2 bags of kettle chips, thrown them on paper plates in the middle of the office. And they'd had something similar. And it's sort of, they said, it's one of those weird family traditions, you know, like families have weird sort of quirks that you only notice when you get enveloped in someone else's family. And they said when their new boss started, their new boss had said, they'd been embarrassed to mention Crisp Thursday, because it just looked like the most stupid thing
good,
ever.
It's good though, because I read about it in the book, and they were theming the day, so sometimes it'd be just Pringles or something, and then
that's right.
You just mentioned Twitter there, so let's discuss that. What was the Christmas party like at Twitter? Where did you do that?
We went to what was that? It sort of brings to mind John Terry and Frank Lampard back in the day. What was it? It was the place on Winsley Street.
Can't remember.
You must know it. It was a Faded Glory. Anyway, it was just off Oxford.
Oh, it's a nightclub.
Yeah.
God, what is that club called?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
You know
the one.
Place. Yeah. Back in the day when you'd always have the Paps outside
Footballers. China Whites.
It was maybe China White. Yeah, I think it was China Whites. China Whites. Okay.
How many people work at Twitter
in UK? Yeah. About in Europe, sort of about 600. UK about 250. So we're relatively small, actually. I mean, if you compare, I think Google's got 5,000 people in London.
What does your vice president, what does that mean?
It's sort of like a fancy... I'm a bit like a sort of hype man in the sense I'm sort of, you know, offering support and backup to people. And I'm a bit like a sort of firefighter. So basically these people who run Twitter in the UK, in France, in Germany. And my job is when things are going wrong to step in and help them.
Right. And they often go wrong.
You know, like I think when you've got something like Twitter, these things in the news all the time. Right. So, you know, quite often you've got someone who all of a sudden finds themselves centre of attention. And so they just need a bit of help on it.
Bruce, I'm just slightly worried because one of the camera monitors has gone off. Mark, are we powered up over there? Because that's just where we're clueless, the two of us. That one over there, Mark, because the monitor's gone off. So I assume it must be not on at the thing. So anyway, is it switched on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So I don't know why that's gone off. Anyway, the plug's in fully.
Yeah, go on, you
can. So I think Twitter's brilliant, by the way. I love it.
Yeah.
It's been one of the things which has changed the world. And I don't think people realise. I think Facebook obviously did quite a bit and MySpace did a lot and all that sort of stuff. But I think Twitter's the one that really has changed the world. Being the fact that it's given people their own PR worldwide, and it's news. It's such big news. So from celebrities to presidents of the United States of America, they have a voice and they can do it without anybody seeing anybody else interfering with their words, which I think is just fascinating.
Yeah. And absolutely. And I think increasingly with politicians, you're going to get to a realm where, you know, and it's not just Twitter, you know, other platforms as well. But the people who are the expert practitioners, the woman I'm sort of enchanted with is Alexandria Ocasio Cortez. I don't know if you know.
No.
She's this new member of the House.
She did the dance.
Yeah,
yes.
And did the dance, exactly that. And, you know, she clearly, you're exactly right for giving her a voice, because clearly the sort of the American news media, Fox News, had turned on her.
Yep.
They were trying to shame her for having this video of her dancing in college. And she was just able to use Twitter, Instagram to get out her side. And pretty quickly, the sting went out of that. I think, you know, most people regard it as having failed. So you're exactly right, you know. Having the ability, I remember hearing John Prescott say back in the day when he was still involved, actively involved in politics, he said that, you know, the Daily Mail might publish an article about him, and at best he could write to them, ask for a retraction, and maybe they'd publish on page 17 a little paragraph saying this wasn't right. Now he can get, you know, tens of thousands of people to tweet and get the story turned around in real time.
And it's depowered the press as well, which is an interesting thing. Noel Edmonds this week did his statement, and he named the Sun newspaper, saying it's lies, and then he named the journalist, and I just thought, wow, that is a real change.
Yeah,
that's a game changer when you're outing the actual journalist and saying, guys, this guy is lying about me, and I've told him, and I thought that's a really interesting thing to happen now. But you have the power to do that. You say it's other platforms as well. I think it's Twitter's the one.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, Ocasio Cortez is quite good on Instagram as well. But yeah, in majority of cases, I think because Twitter's quite good of very snappily, it's like press releases, it's very snappily giving your take on something, that it's worked very well. In fact, even in countries where Twitter's a bit smaller, it's developed this role that, you know, it's used by politicians, it's used by news media, even when it's not as big as Facebook and things.
Yeah, Twitter moves quickly. So even though something will have a huge impact on Instagram, people will use Twitter to move it quickly around, to share it, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's where Twitter's become that medium. How does Twitter make money?
Yeah, advertising. So pretty successful ad business. You know, I think probably the big thing with Twitter was that everyone said, we're 13 years old, and everyone said for a long time, will it ever make a profit? And it sort of became like a weight around our neck, that everyone was like, you'll never make a profit. And so we started making a profit last year, which was, you know, a collective relief to everyone. Shows we're sort of a grown-up business now. But yeah, we sell advertising. So, you know, if you follow Twitter, look, if people who are watching or listening don't use Twitter. Twitter's mainly a news feed. It's a news feed, whether it's Chelsea or whether it's I'm a Celebrity, it sort of brings you the news about the thing that you're interested in. So you might not be interested in Brexit at all, or you might be consumed with Donald Trump, but whatever it is, it brings you the news on that. And we don't use your data. We don't gather a lot of information on you, but we try and show you ads that are relevant to the things that you're following.
Do you find it hard though? Because you must be putting out fires all the time. The press and a lot of the public treat social media as the evil, don't they? I mean, we all love it and use it and addicted to it, but it's treated as an evil source occasionally. Do you find a lot of the time?
Yeah, look, you know, one of the challenges that we have is that people come and they'll conflate something they've seen on Twitter with the organisation, and I think, you know, that's why our big focus is trying to respond very quickly when people, you know, especially the last few years, we've got much faster at responding when people have seen something that they don't like or they find is violent and threatening. So it's about trying to make sure that people feel like it's a safe place to interact.
Yeah, that's about the Zuckerberg thing of, you know, he always said he wanted to make the world a peaceful place through a better place through Facebook. And I assume that's what Twitter wanted to do. Oh, we're going to spread news of love and everything. It ended up with basically public hangings, public shamings. That's what Twitter was used a lot for. It seems to be calming down a little bit, but it's a side effect of the business you put out there.
You know what? I think the lesson for me, I'm going to a school in Coventry tomorrow. I often go into schools and chat. And I think the lesson of all of the internet is that, I mean, look, you know, the way that technology is finally used often bears no relation to how you originally conceived of it.
Yeah.
But the lesson of the whole of the internet is that it reminds us that there's like a massive empathy gap in society. So, you know, people like Jess Phillips, who are a fantastic Labour MP, uses Twitter to really show the full side of herself. And you know, so she'll often illustrate when the things she receives are, you know, less than flattering or that, you know, are sort of threats against her. And the thing that underpins anyone in that situation is that there's often an empathy gap. The person who's sending the message is often from a position of hate, projecting something and trying to get a reaction.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, the challenge is when you work in a company like that is how can you try to ensure that firstly, the bad experience isn't on the burden of the recipient. So, you know, it's not the job of Jess Phillips to spend hours every day reporting tweets and trying to deal with that. How can we try and ensure that it's a good experience for her? And, you know, there's clearly...
You can't. Can you?
There are some ways... What you tend to find is that there are some patterns of behaviour that are innately designed to create harm. I'll give you an example. You've got your main account.
Yeah.
And what we see sometimes is people create what we sometimes style sock puppet accounts. So you've got your main Lovejoy account there. Then all of a sudden, you're angry about something. So you create an account over here to deliberately send abuse. And what we tend to find is there are patterns of behavior. If an account's created and immediately starts sending app messages to someone else, that's a sign that, okay, this isn't someone who's signing up for a new account out of nowhere.
Right.
This is some... And so, you know, if someone immediately creates a new account, then starts sending swear words to strangers, they're pretty big signals that that's trollish behaviour. So there are a lot of things that we can do that... So in that situation...
Hard to police
that. Yeah, in that situation, we might send a phone verification for someone.
Right.
So we just say, hey, thanks for that tweet. Can you just confirm your phone?
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then they stop.
What you tend to find, like majority of the cases...
Yeah.
First thing, like there was some brilliant work about abuse in gaming communities. The one thing, like if you're an online gamer, they often use the word gay to each other. So like someone will, and what researchers found when they were looking at online gaming communities is that the trolls didn't realize they were the trolls.
Right.
So, you know, you just played a game of FIFA with someone, you get annoyed, you send some abuse down the line to that person. It wasn't until the sort of the people administering the system pointed out that that was abusive behaviour. It wasn't till that happened that people realised they were the problem. And so what you tend to find in that situation is when you send a notification to someone saying, just so you know, you've been flagged as a troll. Normally, the first response of everyone is to say, what, me?
Yeah,
okay. I tell you where you get a lot of it right now is that, you know, look, political debate is more factionalised than ever before, isn't it? So you're about Brexit or about the Scottish independence referendum, you get a lot of people who are convinced the righteousness of their situation, position, and the abhorrence of the opposite situation. And so, you know, they often, people think it's their right to send the C word to David Cameron or to send the C word to Jeremy Corbyn. People believe that they're allowed to do that. They're not the trolls. Everyone else is the problem. And when you remind them that that's antisocial behaviour and, you know, there's going to be a consequence of that, they're often quite, well, firstly, they're quite upset with Twitter rather than upset with themselves. But it's just a way to try and improve. And look, it's a hard thing.
Hold a mirror up to them. And
yeah.
Then, yeah. Okay. I have an interesting relationship with Twitter. I was obsessed with it at one stage. I had to slow right down because I was getting so much abuse. And I felt that I had to defend my corner all the time. And then I realised that actually defending your corner is the worst thing you can do.
What were you getting abuse about?
Football.
Right.
But basically anything. A lot of the stuff I did. But generally because it was football. I used to comment a lot on football. Yeah. And I used to try and defend everything. And I was like, why am I defending? And the worst thing you can do, and also, is to try and when people send abusive things to you, is actually to reply to them, because no one bothers going on your timeline to read what people are saying to you unless you respond to it. So that's how I did. But it's really funny, that whole football fan thing of they feel that they can absolutely abuse you. And the other thing that I found was quite interesting is when they were upset with Chelsea Football Club or Chelsea football fans or any Chelsea football players, I would get included, so they would insult me because I'm connected to the club somehow.
But tell me this, don't you?
The only thing I've done with the club, by the way, is give them money. Yeah. They've never given me anything, so there you go.
Don't you think it's a little bit societal as well? You know, one of the interesting things when we set up the London Twitter office is that we had to explain to our American colleagues the nature of sport in Britain. Because if you go to an American sport game, there's no away fans, so you don't have like this history of barracking and abuse. You don't have songs about like a team from Chicago. And so we had to explain to them that, you know, to some extent, sport in the UK is quite tribal. I mean, like, you know, it's beyond quite tribal, it's very tribal. And we had to explain to them that, you know, you've got natural sort of adversity between different teams, and we were seeing an articulation of it on Twitter. And so, you know, it's just an interesting thing from their perspective. You know, sometimes it sort of makes Britain seem very raw in comparison to what they were seeing in the US. So we had to explain, look, you know, Chelsea, Tottenham, there's more than you would imagine if you were just imagining the New York Jets versus...
Exactly, but behind a keyboard, it's always a lot more fierce than in real life, generally, because no one comes up to me and says anything to me.
I saw a tweet by David Baddiel this morning. He was talking about another social platform, and he said, you know, all very pretty and everything, but where's the funny? And I think, you know, that's the critical thing about Twitter, is that the combination of all those intellects, that hive mind, often, especially if you're watching a game or if you're watching, you know, some weird thing going on, it often finds the funny.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be watching an episode of Luther and just something hilarious happens and people find the funny in things. And I think the critical thing when you're running a platform like that is, how can you make sure that you're trying to learn all the time about how to make it better, safer, and, you know, respond to the cases that, you know, that get reported, but not sucking the heart out of it.
This is what happened with Twitter, because I did Soccer M for years, 11 years, and it was all just about the humour of the game. And we loved it. Everyone loved the players, loved it. The fans loved it. We all loved football. And then suddenly you move on to Twitter and you realise there's this kind of section of people who are miserable football fans who hate the world. They're very political. And then they suddenly had a voice. So the majority of us who all enjoyed the sport, suddenly they were like really, we hate everybody. And it was really angry. And it really soured football for me for a while, that actually having access exposure to those sorts of people. I just want to talk about one more thing before we move on from Twitter. How's the hate speech versus freedom of speech juggling going? Because that seems to be the big issue. All the American podcasters talk about that a lot. And it seems to be one of those really big things with social media, what you're supposed to close down because it's hate speech, but it actually, what is freedom of speech?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, that's certainly when Twitter was created. So Twitter was created like as a little way to text updates of what you're doing. It was like back in the day, MSN Messenger. It was like that was sort of the precursor to it, that what you were doing. No one would have expected sort of the evolution into that. Look, you know, those things, I think, are imagine how nuanced they are, because firstly, you've got to try and act as an independent arbiter of what goes on. So, you know, I'll give you a classic example. A lot of people will come and say, this person should not be allowed a voice on the platform. And, you know, these accounts, that account shouldn't be there. And of course, you know, the immense challenge is if that person's not saying anything that's pernicious or bad, try and arbitrate, and for a private company, or, you know, a publicly listed company or whatever, try and arbitrate those things is really difficult. I think, you know, it's the balance we strike. I think we're getting better at it all the time of trying to strike the right balance. But, you know, there'll be no shortage of people who say, you know, that politician shouldn't be getting, Nigel Farage shouldn't be allowed to tweet. People say things like that. And so, you know, I think what we've tried to tread the balance of is being balanced, and actually the way we've tried to do it is just involve far more people. So our CEO Jack Dorsey tries to do all of our thinking in public, which is sort of, you know, so he spoke to the Senate, he spoke to the House of Representatives last year. I think, you know, the overall feedback that everyone gave from that was it didn't feel rehearsed, it didn't feel like he was going through talking points, it felt like he was trying to demystify the way that we think about those things. And I think that's what we've realised. Quite often, a benign decision, if it's made in private, feels shady. It feels sort of, why have they done that? Whereas if you show you're working out, back to sort of, you know, this the school lesson, if you show, here's how we made this decision, people might disagree with it, but they tend to think it's less...
See where it's come from.
Yeah, yeah. They tend to think it's less sort of malign, really.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with social media is employers. The idea that you're going to lose your job. So you've got to be very... I was reading, I Googled you, and there's a few things you've said which people have picked up on and gone, oh, he said this, he said that. Obviously, Twitter go, oh, God, no, he didn't, or whatever, you're misconstruing it. I think employers have to have a responsibility to go, okay, they said something stupid on Twitter, but they're not a bad person. Tell them, don't do that again. You haven't lost your job. But the knee-jerk reaction from everyone always is get rid of their job. Let's distance ourselves from the problem and sack them. And I think that is a problem, that we just keep sacking people all the time. It's because of a Twitter outrage.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I think it's anything to do with the news, isn't it? Do you remember back in the day, there'd be sort of News of the World exposés of, you know, the saucy vicar. And there was always, look, you know, any time attention focuses on something, these, unfortunately, certainly the media feeds this sort of bloodlust for it.
Well, you have to trust your employers. But let's get on to your book, because you discussed that in the book, right? The book is The Joy of Work, 30 Ways to Fix Your Work Culture and Fall in Love with Your Job Again. It came because you started doing a podcast called Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, which I've listened to, very good. It's about the workplace. Explain how the process came.
So, I mean, you know, you'll be fortunate in this, Tim, but I reckon the average state of, and look, actually it's not me reckoning it, it's stats, so that the average worker in Britain is in a state of exhaustion. Half of all people feel burnt out, and there's some really sad stats about it. So, you know, I saw last year the Mental Health Foundation said that 3/4 of people in the previous 12 months had felt overwhelmed with stress at some point in the last 12 months, and the main cause of that was work. And so people are in this situation where work, when it's good, it can be like our motivation in life. It can give us our mojo. Yeah. You know, people who have jobs are happier than people who don't have jobs. So, you know, work, we shouldn't be embarrassed to say we love our job. When, you know, when things are going well, we shouldn't be embarrassed to have a joy of working with the colleagues we work with, doing the job we do. But the challenge of modern work is that work's way less fun than it used to be. Like, unequivocally way less fun than it used to be. And so I was interested. I worked in McDonald's, I worked in Wimpy, I worked in bars. I've worked in sort of all manner of scrappy jobs. And I was really interested that, you know, that one Mexican restaurant I worked in was horrible, but that bar I worked in, what's the reason why sometimes workplaces feel fantastic and sometimes they don't? And, you know, not a big secret. A couple of years ago, my job at Twitter, I think, you know, I looked around the people I was around and I thought, you know, I'm not the only one feeling exhausted, burnt out, and sort of like, I can't keep doing this. Everyone around me looked the same. It looked like sort of the Thriller video. Everyone was sort of bleeping in and stumbling into their desks. And I was just interested in the science of it. What's the way to make work better? And, you know, I started looking into it. And the mad thing about the science of it is the science almost completely contradicts what most people do in work. The most obvious example is open plan offices. If you look into any of the science of open plan, almost every office in the UK knows open plan.
Yeah.
The science of it says you're going to get way less done, you're going to be in a state of dissatisfaction, and you'll like your colleagues less.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like everyone just ignores that science.
Can I just back that up, by the way? I read that in the book, and the other side of it, which you said, which is interesting, is the reason why everyone has open plan offices, it saves money.
Yeah, about a third of the cost.
So that's why. Yeah. But the science says it's not as good.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, the sad thing about when anything becomes cheaper, right? It's like when any benefit's been cut, you can never see a way to it to coming back.
Yeah.
But it's way cheaper. So constantly, more and more firms are doing it.
So you decided to start a podcast, did you first? Well, obviously you did that first, and then the book has come from the podcast, hasn't it?
Yeah, largely because I did this podcast, and the interesting thing about it is that it was sort of self-education, really.
Yeah.
And there's something beneficial about feeling like you sort of you're learning something. And what I found was that I was getting travel agent in Gloucester contact me, you know, police force in Lancashire.
Oh, brilliant.
I was getting like these mad people approaching me. And the interesting thing is, almost universally, everyone was saying, yeah, everyone at my work is exhausted and people can't cope anymore. And there was a really interesting thing that, you know, it was just hitting upon, okay, it's not just me feeling like I can't do this much longer. Everyone's got it. I live sort of North London. I was at the train station about 12 months ago, and you're watching people coming in from sort of suburbs, and you look at everyone and you think, it's not just me feeling like I'm in Shaun of the Dead. Everyone else is in this state where we've been told retirement age is now 70, maybe higher. We've got another 30, 40 years of this, and I'm not sure I can cope. And I was just interested in, okay, so if we can't carry on the way we're doing it, are there ways to improve it? And so I just started. So, like, you know, often the thing when you talk about work culture, gurus about work culture will say, oh, you need to get a sense of purpose. And, you know, they'll use this word purpose all the time. You've got to know why you're doing it. And let me tell you, you know, I've worked in purpose-driven organizations. I've worked in Google. I work at Twitter. Everyone at Twitter feels a sense of passion about, you know, the things you've talked about there. Twitter's changing the world of politics, of expression. Everyone feels it. But purpose on its own doesn't get you through Monday to Friday if you're just exhausted by your job. So that's why I was interested in finding the science of it, really.
Okay, what's the point of work?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, firstly, it's sort of clearly it's got a financial imperative to it, hasn't it?
Is that the point? Do you think that is it? That is why? Because I started reading your book and I thought, this is interesting, but why are we all, what is the big machine happening here? Is it just as an individual, you talk about purpose?
There's a big thing in America at the moment about individuals who are trying to raise enough money. It's got a name, I forget the name of it. It's in, there's a book coming out by a guy called Cal Newport called Digital Minimalism, coming out in a couple of months. And his big thing there is that these people in America are trying to earn enough money, and they've realised that to survive every year, you need about a third of what you think you need. So you live on like this close to subsistence existence.
Mr. Money Moustache, that guy.
But you basically, you're not setting about to have any consumer needs, and you do a lot less. And so hopefully you get more of a balance between you and work. But what you find in those situations is we get some of our self-esteem from our job. We get, we get a sense of who we are. So if you look at people who don't have jobs, they tend to, they suffer from depression more, they die sooner. It's the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. not having a job versus having a job. So there's something about our identity that comes from having a job.
I was talking to an MP from Sunderland once, and the unemployment was huge up there. I don't know if it still is, but potentially it is. And he said there's generations of men who have no work to do. And he said it's not the fact that they're scrounging off the rest of us. They want to get up in the morning and do something and go to work and have some pride in what they're doing. He goes, that is the problem. Yeah. It's not the money. It's the mental side of it.
So that's the purpose thing that a lot of people talk about. But I think when you're in a job, quite often that gets shrouded by the fact that you've got, you know, the average British person has 16 hours of meetings a week. Mm. And, you know, the average working day went up when people accepted email onto their phones, which felt like a good idea at the time. It felt like, you know, I'm on the tube somewhere. Yeah, I'll just get rid of it. Right. But the average working day went up by 2 hours a day. And the end result of all of those things is that most people feel, the state of emotion they feel most commonly at work is guilt. I didn't get to the bottom of my inbox. I didn't get back to Gavin. I didn't turn up for that meeting.
It's a pretty new thing though, isn't it? Because the iPhone, someone put a picture. Steve
12 years, G- yeah.
Yeah, 2007. Mm. So he held it up today, 2007. So obviously the BlackBerry was before that, was it?
A couple of years, wasn't it?
So yeah. It's not that long that we've been able to get emails while we're sitting on a train commuting or on a bus or
and
something.
And look, the big promise of it, I remember when email came onto people's phones and there was a queue at the IT offices. You know, like when it happened in my work, John went round to the IT guy and said, I need a BlackBerry so I can get emails on the go. Everyone saw John had a little BlackBerry on his desk. It was like, what did you say? What combination of words got you that magical little phone? And that was it. We were all really excited about doing it. It just felt like...
The workplace has changed dramatically. My friend he's been at a fashion conference. I can't remember where he is, Zurich or somewhere, in a fashion conference. And I asked him what the highlights were, and he said the suit is nearly dead. He said people who are designing ties are having a nightmare because the global sales of ties are just absolutely hemorrhaging, because even if you wear a suit, you don't wear a tie anymore. Yeah. It's uncomfortable. But he said, apart from places like the city, no one wears a suit anymore. Yeah. The workplace is changing dramatically. Then we've got the open plan offices, and we've got all the technology as well.
Do you remember there was a time, though, if you were if you put on a suit, because you were wearing it 9 to 5, the idea of putting a suit on to go out and look fancy with your partner was just like, why would I do that?
Yeah.
Whereas increasingly, suits are sort of a fashion wear, I guess, aren't they?
There's no suits at Twitter, is there?
Not really.
No.
The people who meet politicians wear them.
Only if they're coming to do contracts or legal stuff or finance. Okay, so... you've got the book and you split it into three sections. The first section is called Recharge, then you've got Sync, and then you've got Buzz. So explain the three sections.
The Recharge bit is that, you know, a lot of people say, I want to fix work culture. And then I was chatting to a charity last week and they said, look, we want to fix our culture. But the problem is that every time we try and fix it, we invite people to a meeting and everyone's just so dead by... The volume of work they've got to do. No one wants another meeting. The dread of a 3-hour meeting going in.
Oh, meetings, Jesus.
Yeah. And so the first bit I thought is that, you know, for all this fancy talk about work culture and, you know, I've worked at some of the places that claim to be the best cultures in the world, actually you need to get energy back into people. You need people to feel like they're alive again. So hence the Recharge bit. The Sync bit for me was the most interesting part. I started from a perspective of thinking... the best workplaces are the ones that we laugh a lot. And then, and you know, like, and especially in recessionary times, and you know, like, who knows whether we're going to enter more of a recession. You reach a stage sometimes where you're like, should I be laughing right now? You know, the things are on a downturn, things are looking bad. And I've had bosses who've wandered past saying, don't be spotted laughing. don't let the sort of the big boss see you laughing. And so you start thinking, laughter sort of made me feel happier at work, but am I meant to feel guilty about it? So the Sync part was just some incredible science I found about going to look at how human beings bond and interact with each other. And so there's some the stuff I find really fascinating about that is that you can find things where you put rowers together. So this one guy, a guy called Robin Dunbar, very famous guy, he did a couple of experiments. One where he got a group of rowers to row just as fast as they could on rowing machines, then got a separate group of rowers and said, your rowing's only really going to work if you're in time with each other. It's the equivalent of you rowing on a boat. Scientists do this weird thing where they inflict pain on people, and they do it by sort of putting an inflatable cuff around your arm,
okay,
and then putting as much air in it as possible. And they're not deliberately trying to cause harm, but basically the amount of pleasure hormone that you've got in your body allows you to take more pain.
Okay.
And so what they found was the rowers who rowed in sync with each other were able to take twice the amount of pain as the rowers who weren't. These are clearly buff rowers, right? They're not sort of feeble people, but they were able to take twice as much pain. So there's a weird thing about, and you get it with dancers, you get it with people in choirs, you get it with, you get this weird thing when people feel connected to the people around them. Then you start looking at it. What's the other ways to activate sync? Laughing together is one of the most powerful ways. Face-to-face chat is another way. And so these little ways of activating that, they might seem, you know, I guess sometimes we hear about the future of work and we all think, well, maybe it'll be all of us working remotely, dialing in, doing our emails from our home. And what you realize is there's some sort of magical dark science. It's like a dark matter of when people are around other people and they feel connected to them, it just increases their happiness. It makes them do more than they would otherwise have done.
Yeah, in your book you say working remotely increases stress, anxiety, and depression.
Yeah, that's right. Like the UN did something where they looked at globally the state of happiness of people in their jobs. And I think about it was 23-24% of people generally are stressed in their jobs globally, and 42% of people who work from home. And the reason generally is that if you work from home, you tend to think everyone thinks you're lazy.
Right.
Most people who work from home, the average thing that they worry about is what their boss thinks about them. And it's just that simple thing that actually if you chat face to face with people, it changes the sort of, it changes your trust, it changes the way you work with people. So it's not to say you can't work from home, but when people have worked from home and it's been successful, it's generally because they've put effort into meeting face to face first.
And the final one is the buzz.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, quite often you find workplaces where people go, you know what, there was almost like there was a hum to that office. There was like people, often when people describe the best places they work in, they say there was a real buzz to that place. And so I was really interested, what's the science of that? And probably the thing that underpins that is something called psychological safety, which sounds a bit jargony, but it's basically the ability to speak up to the boss. The ability to say to the person with power, I think this is a bad idea. And so I was interested, I met a guy who was in the British Special Forces, and he told me he was in the, you know, military Special Forces. I said, I thought you weren't allowed to tell people you're in the Special Forces. He said, you're not allowed to tell them in the pub. He said, you're not allowed to tell them, 4 pints in, you're not allowed to tell them you're in sort of the elite military. But if it facilitates a good business conversation, you're allowed to say it. Anyway, right. He said that, you know, that's obviously a really critical thing. How can you build psychological safety? If you're doing a military maneuver, you need to hear from everyone, whether they're the top person, the lower person. And he said they do something called a hot debrief. At the end of every day, you might be in Camp Bastion, you might be sort of out in Borneo somewhere. You're doing a military maneuver. And they all stand at the end of the day. They stand round and they describe what's happened. But he'll be the first to say what he did wrong. And I thought that's really interesting. He said, firstly, in the military, we don't have any orders. You know, normally, like, because we all imagine, like, the army, there's someone giving orders and then the soldiers follow that. He said, it's not that. That's a sign that things have gone wrong. You know, we discuss what the plan is, we discuss what we're going to do, but he's the first to say when things have gone wrong. So I thought that was sort of an interesting one. If you could try and build a buzz in the office, it's as much about knowing that you can speak truth to power as anything else.
Yeah, we had Jason Fox on here, who's ex-SBS, and he said that you've got to trust your person you work with, and you also can't lie or do anything like that, you know. That. And he found when he moved into the workplace, from being in the military, suddenly there was people lying and he couldn't believe it. And he wanted to, like, you know, get very angry with them, basically, because he's like, these people are actually lying in the workplace. He couldn't believe it, because you can't do that in the military or you get killed, you know. So
it's so opposite. Right. I was so interested in how what a different take he had.
And the biggest problem with work, I always say this on the podcast, it's a game. It's not real life, because sadly it's not the rules of life. This is what I believe anyway, is suddenly you're there and you've got a boss bullying you and he's all got all the power. There's very little you can do about it. You've mentioned many examples in your book of this sort of thing. And there was one woman who ended up writing a blog, didn't she?
Yeah.
And then the whole, that was Uber, wasn't it?
That's right, and Fowler.
The whole culture of Uber was found out.
Absolutely.
And they had to, the top. But often you're in the stupid game, and that can get very stressful. You have to realise that you're in a game sometimes.
Yeah, and look, you know, the challenge often is power dynamics, isn't it? So exactly that. So Susan Fowler's like a really inspiring example. She was a 27-year-old engineer at Uber, and she wrote this blog about her experience. She only worked at Uber for about 8 or 9 months. She wrote this blog largely as personal catharsis.
Yeah.
She was like, I've got to get this out of my system. No one's going to read this. She ended up being the Financial Times Person of the Year. As part of the Me Too movement, she became like the Time Person of the Year. Amazing that a, you know, 20-something can end up being recognised as having changed the culture of the biggest private company in the world. Mm. But just an illustration, really, that firstly, you know, work, our experience of it is often power dynamics. And the best companies are the ones where they try and push that power dynamic so it doesn't feel like it's changing things.
But how do you deal with that if you're an individual? You're an individual in a company and there's power dynamics going on all around you.
Yeah, that was why I was interested. I think that, you know, bosses don't read books like this. And so I was really interested, can one passionate person with a bit of evidence change their work culture? And so that was my feeling. If you give them 3 bits of evidence, you know, each chapter sort of 10, 15 pages, and it's almost like rip it out, photocopy it, and let's try and change how things are around here, then you can hopefully, you know, you can hopefully adapt the way that things are. Most bosses aren't like these superhero villains, you know. If you turn up, like your team away day, you've booked somewhere, you go into sort of the upstairs room of a pub, you've got a team away day, someone can say, guys, I wonder if we could talk about this, how we do meetings around here, or the fact that people are emailing all weekend. Can we change the way that we do our team socialising? You know, I think passionate people with a bit of evidence can change things. Maybe I'm excessively optimistic. Really.
No, I don't think so. And the book is not, you know, I assumed to begin with, the book was just for employers. It's actually for everyone.
Yeah,
isn't
that's it?
So you read it and you can think, how can I change my workplace? And there's individual things you can do and also team things you can do. One of the individual things you can do, if we go back to the beginning, recharge, because I've actually done it since I've been back, your monk mode morning, and it works and it's brilliant. Explain what that is.
Yeah, so monk mode morning comes from the idea that you know, the curse of modern work is interruptions. And look, you know, everything on your phone and everything you could accuse me of.
Twitter.
But, you know, interruptions is the curse of modern work. When you look at, it's really interesting when you sort of look into where creative ideas come from or where productive work comes from. Productive work tends to come from concentration. So, you know, good work comes from concentration. And the idea is that, you know, you're in the middle of an open plan office, you've got 16 hours of meetings a week, 140 emails a day. There's no respite from interruption. And so the idea of monk mode morning is maybe once a week or twice a week, you give yourself 60 minutes or 90 minutes just to get something done with no interruptions. And what you find, the people who do it, they say, you know what, I thought that was going to take me a week. That took me an hour of concentrated work. And actually, like that document, I've been needing to do that for ages. It just gave me a bit of headspace. And so it's just about trying to say, okay, maybe twice a week. I'm not sort of trying to change the world, but being a monk mode morning. So monk, you know, a monk sort of no interruptions, no talk, no distraction. For a monkey giving you an hour, you're giving yourself the opportunity to get something done. And it really works. I mentioned there about where creative ideas come from. And, you know, we often sit there. Someone will say to you, can you send some ideas over? And the challenge of sitting there, you're staring at your screen, you've got the keyboard in front of you, like, where the creative ideas come from? And what you find is, in the brain, creative ideas tend to come from two ideas hitting each other, right? They're like, they're combinations of different things. It's not, how about if we did that, but it's there? How about we did, you know, it's sort of, you're adding different things together. And creative ideas tend to come from what's called the default network in your brain. That's basically when you're doing nothing. It's why people say, you know what, I was walking to work today and, you know, it just occurred to me this. Or quite often people say, I was in the shower and I thought of this. And, you know, what I always say to people is think about the last, next time you have a creative idea, try and make a note of when it happens. Because, my favourite example is the guy who wrote The Social Network, he wrote The West Wing, a guy called Aaron Sorkin. And he said he realised all his good ideas were coming when he was in the shower. So he built a shower, I mean, Hollywood prerogative, but he built a shower into the corner of his office.
No.
And he has eight showers. He said when he's like in the middle of a project, he has 8 to 10 showers a day.
Wow.
Yeah. So like, it's just an interesting one. Where's your creative? So, you know, we're all sitting there.
Well, I love it. You've got loads of great ideas in here. And one of them is the walking meeting. And I love that idea because I talk about walking. I don't know if you know, but on this podcast, we do a mailbag as well where I answer people's problems. And I always say, go for a walk. It's a great form of meditation, actually, walking. And I've never thought about this before, but you say take a walking meeting. And I remember walking around once with, we had to go for a little meeting in Soho. And I'd had this idea for Yorkshire News, which was a slot on Soccer AM years ago, and I had an idea for it, but I'd been working on it for about 2 years. It's never happened. And I went for a walk with Fenners, who presents the show now, and I worked with him. And during that walk, we managed to come up with a whole concept of how it worked. Then it ran for about 5 or 6 seasons. But it was actually getting out of the office and walking. It really good for your head.
A couple of things on it. So, walking's really good for creative thinking. What you find is that, you know, the science that's all in there, but, you know, 81% of people who go for a walk have more ideas and they have 2/3 more ideas. Like so you have good creative thinking. The careful thing you've got to have, though, is test who you're going to do a walk with. Because there's definitely, every office has got an office curmudgeon, hasn't there? And so if you go and you say to, you know, the wrong person, let's go for a walking meeting, you'll never do another one. You know, I'd be like, that was one of the most awkward half an hours of my life. I'm never going to do that again. You get the right person and it can become part of your weekly routine. My favourite part of that actually was, I say it in there, was people often worry about the secrecy of going for a walk. And people like, if I'm out and about, you know, you're talking TV ideas there. If I'm out and about, people might steal my idea. And the mafia actually said, the sort of the quotation they gave, there's one guy who once turned witness in a mafia trial, New York mafia trial. And he said their philosophy was never talk on the phone, never talk in a club, never talk in a house, never talk on a cell phone. You only do talking when you're walking. And it's like, it's just...
If it's good enough for the mafia.
Exactly that. Exactly that. Anyone who's worried about their financial plan for 2019 being leaked by a stroll is sort of misguided.
The problem, always the problem with the workplace is you kind of want to make sure people are busy. And as an employer, I imagine, I've only sort of really worked in... I worked in a few proper jobs years ago. Finance and stuff like that, and you've always got to sort of look busy. I'm interested in people like Tim Ferriss who actually book in weeks at a time where they do nothing but just think, because it's important. But it's tough to say to your employer, I just need a week to think. Think.
That's a funny thing, isn't it? Because like, you know,
we know it could probably be beneficial to the company.
That's it. I was chatting to a creative person and he said, he said early in his career, he was sort of staring out a window and someone said, have you got nothing to do? And they said, this is me working. And it's, I think the problem is with modern work, especially with, your diary, maybe sort of before the time of some of your listeners, but your diary used to be something, your work diary used to be something that you sort of protected and was on your desk. If someone came and tried to put a meeting in, you'd ask what it was about. Your diary was zealously guarded. Now your diary is public property. And so if people see that you've got an afternoon with no meetings, the weird way that work has evolved is people see you've got an afternoon with no meetings and they think you're doing nothing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we just need to redress those things. Well, I'm firmly of the opinion we need to abolish half of all meetings.
Yeah.
Just, you know, like if you have a look, people who study the benefit of working, they say that meetings account for about 2% of what we get done in a week.
You do also say, though, when you have a meeting, not to bring any technology into it.
Yeah. It's hard, that, isn't it?
But I think you're right, though. I've sat in many meetings where I'm talking and I'm watching somebody else on a phone or a computer thinking, you're not listening. You can't. Yeah. It's impossible for your brain to do two things at one time.
I think the reason why, it's coping mechanism. If you've got 2 days a week of meetings, then you're sort of being held hostage, aren't you? You're sort of being taken into a room. Someone's taking your time. And so we use mobile devices to just try and crack through some of those emails. If you accept that you can have fewer meetings, then you can prevent that.
Who was it in the book who said that they they don't do any presentations anymore? They make people read.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It's Amazon's philosophy. So right. Amazon, if you chat to anyone at Amazon,
oh, they're doing all right, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. Shout out to them. Like, you know, the one thing I think anyone would say is that Amazon are doing all right. But they barely have any meetings. And the reason why, they say, is that before every meeting, and it's like an introvert's dream, but like it sounds deeply awkward. They have this weird thing where you don't have a meeting unless there's a document. So someone has to prepare a document, and it's often sort of 3 or 4 page document. And first thing they do is they know that any time in history that people have sent a pre-read document, and it, you know, here's the slides so you can read beforehand, no one reads the slides. It's like this biggest fallacy ever. And so they know that men are worse than that, that women. So they say, so you write a 4-page document, you turn up and everyone sits and reads it in silence. Mm. And it sort of brings back the exam hall for me, you know, like the swatty kid putting his hand up for more paper. But you sit there and everyone reads the document in silence. And then after about 15 minutes, they then start having a discussion. But they say the end result of it is you have far fewer meetings.
I'd be really conscious that I'm not reading fast enough.
I know.
Oh, God, everybody else is reading and I'm slow and I'm so. Interesting about Jeff Bezos. How do you say his name?
Bezos.
Bezos. Interesting, I was reading about him once, and he said the best thing that he ever did, best business decision, was getting knee pads for the people in the office so that they could actually pack all the stuff into the boxes. Up until then, they were getting uncomfortable on the knees. Amazing. And having to move them. The other thing I read about him the other day is he makes $1,000 a minute. $191,000 a minute. And if you were from the age of from birth, you were going to earn $1 a minute, you would have to wait until you were 3,500 years old before you had as much money as him.
Right.
It's insane how much money that man has.
Yeah, incredible.
And I've been thinking about this quite a lot, actually, because what is he doing with all that money? What I find quite disturbing when we've got a lot of people are not disturbing, really. It's just kind of weird that you've got Bill Gates, who gives all his profits away, and all the people who make a lot of money. Why aren't they putting them back into the employees? Surely that's a better thing to do, to go, okay, I've got so much money, I either cut my profits down and give it back to the customer, or I give some to the, I double the workforce so everyone works half as much, or I'm just an old hippie, aren't I? That's just...
I'll tell you what, though, I was chatting to someone just before Christmas who, she studied American supermarkets, American retail, because I guess Amazon owns Whole Foods now, and she found that the companies that paid workers more were twice as profitable as the ones that don't. So there is some, you know, there's some, as well as altruism, there's some sort of business sense.
Yeah. All right. Just one other thing before we move on from recharge, which is always good. The lunch break, as you point out, and everybody always says, is very important. And the idea of you're lazy because you're taking a lunch break, or you're not as dedicated, is just very old fashioned, isn't it?
Very Anglo-Saxon as well. You know, if you say to French people, you know, we've got an office in France, in Spain. If you say to French people, make sure you take your lunch break, they stare at you wondering what you're talking about. Of course, they'll take their lunch break. It's sort of very Anglo-Saxon. It's very sort of American and British not to take a lunch break. But the science of breaks is fascinating. The worst time to find yourself in hospital is towards the end of the day. The clinical errors at the end of the day in hospital, when, you know, sort of after lunch and long way away from a break, the worst time is there. The clinical errors are 4 times as high as in the morning. So if you're going to go to hospital, make sure you go first thing. Worst time to find yourself in court just before lunch. And so, you know, you want to make sure that you sort of... any sort of break tends to have this effect that it makes us a bit kinder hearted. It makes us a bit better in terms of our judgments. And so stepping away from your desk, even if it's only for 20 minutes, You know, it often feels, if you're sitting there and you've got 70 emails, you think, I'm going to crack the back of these. I'm going to get through these. And actually what you find is by stepping away from the desk, you get through the emails much quicker.
When you're syncing people, the second part of your book, you're basically, what you're saying is you're trying to get people together. You're trying to get them into a team.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's one bit of the chapter where you say, just move the kettle.
Yeah.
It can help.
Yeah. It's a weird thing that, you know, like the amount of time that we spend thinking who's going to be in which team with who and who's the boss of that team. And the people who've studied it have said where the kettle is or where the water cooler is. Maybe you can't move the kettle, but you might have like one of those big water bottles. Where you place that bottle has a big impact of which teams talk to who.
I worked at a company. I'm not going to say which one, but I worked in a restaurant. And they, one of their employment strategies was to employ people from outside the area. The reason being is they didn't have as many friends in the area.
What, so they wouldn't have their mates come in?
No, it means they would socialise with each other. Okay. Literally, they would employ people from out of town. Wow. So that they would try and get them to live near it. I'm not saying that I did that on Soccer M, but there was a lot of people from all over the country who worked on Soccer M in my production team. But we did build a real bond, and once you get that bond going, you can produce some real magic, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know that feeling that when you've got a really good team dynamic, work feels like a pleasure. You don't feel like those zombies coming in on the train. And even if you're, you know, look, even if you're working hard, there's some magic to it.
Mm. I always get a bit shocked when I go to offices, though, and media is a bit different, I think. I don't know what the culture's like at Twitter, but it's kind of, there doesn't seem to be as structured rules. Is there a problem, do you think, in the workplace that people aren't treated like adults, and the way you left school moves into your workplace, where you've got the boss and he's looking down on you and you're scared about the hours you're working? The sort of media environments I've worked at, people are pretty much left to their own devices. Right. If you don't produce the work, then you're in trouble.
Right.
That's kind of the way it is. Is there still that sort of culture?
Yeah, I think most people's experience of work is there are a lot of rules. If you're not in by 9:30, if you stroll into the office at 11, most people find they're in a situation where, you know, their boss calls them out on it, asks where they were.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we turn adults into infants a bit, don't we? Yeah, but yeah, that's the... it's not an uncommon experience. Most people in the UK, I suspect, recognise that.
Yeah. But back to the buzz thing. We were discussing power struggles before, and we were discussing things like that. I suppose the important thing when you get into when you really become a good team is the ability to admit when you've mucked up.
Yeah.
That's the hard thing to do, isn't it?
I think that's the really critical thing. The one of these studies was really interesting. Looking at exactly that, modelling people saying they've made a mistake, and they were looking at a surgical team when they were introducing open heart surgery. So, like until the keyhole version of open heart surgery, they used to crack your ribs open. It's almost like a Chinese buffet. They'd crack your ribs open, operate on your heart. And then someone, you know, 15 years ago said, I've got a new technique. We're going to go up through your leg, tiny little incision. And so the professor who was studying this looked at the teams who succeeded and the teams who failed. So like mega hard, you know, they said initially it could take you 40 operations before you got the hang of it. What they found was the ones who were the most successful were the ones where the lead person was willing to say, I messed that up. Or was willing to say, what's anyone think? I've no idea what I'm doing here. And the people who sort of modelled vulnerability, like, you know, uncertainty, the ones who said, guys, shout out what's going on here because I don't know, were the ones that were way more successful. The ones where you've got like this sort of superhero surgeon who claiming that he knows what's going on, they often abandoned the process. So it's like that.
Yeah.
It's like the more you say you don't know what's going on, the better it is, really.
Yeah, it's tough to do sometimes.
It is. It really is. That's the hard thing, isn't it? And we're so enchanted. Look, you know, politics is a good example of it. We're so taken with people who show certainty, aren't they? Here's the answers. You know, if a politician stands up and says, oh, this is a total mess, I don't know what we're going to do, but I'm going to try my best, it just doesn't look anywhere near as persuasive.
Now, okay, so I started the interview by saying, what's the point of working? What does success look like when you work, do you think? If you've done all this work on good work culture, the joy of work, what does it look like, success?
it's been sustainable, really. I think, you know, it's all very well to have a job where you're buzzing off it for a couple of years, you're mega energized, and then you feel like you collapse. There was a really interesting article this weekend in the New York Times, and it said that it was talking about millennial burnout. You know, I know millennials are sort of an unuseful term because it basically means anyone under 40 these days, doesn't it? But, you know, millennial burnout. And it was saying that the expectation has become so high on millennials that they'll be just working all the time. That the end outcome of that is when it comes to sorting out their rent payments or sorting out, you know, some personal details, they just haven't got the energy for it. So, you know, I think the critical thing of good work, and I think that's what you talk about, is just
success,
something you can,
yeah.
Sustainable. Not that, sustainable. You know, you have like this adrenalized, hardworking year, 2 years, but that, you know, it's something that you can feel happy in for a long time.
Should if you're a boss, should you be socializing with your staff?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any issue with it. What do you think?
Well, I think you should. Yeah. I really
Christmas
do.
Christmas party.
Yeah. Yeah, avoid the Christmas party. No, I think you should.
Yeah.
Because I think that's how it works. But I mean, I firmly believe in trying to depower any form of production that I work on, because I just think the power struggles, just they don't produce the most creative ideas.
That. If people are scared to say their ideas, I say something about Trevor Noah, the guy, the sort of comedian guy who does The Daily Show in the US. And, you know, it's really interesting. If there's a power dynamic in the room, people don't bring their jokes to that environment. Yeah. They don't. And so, you know, you need to try and get the power out of the room, because people bring their best ideas.
I think you want someone to be able to come up with an idea and feel comfortable when you go, that idea's rubbish, and they still feel comfortable by it because they laugh. We all laugh. Everyone laughs together, and then we go, what's the next idea?
And I guess probably the secret is them being able to say to you that idea's rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've had plenty of rubbish ideas.
we've got something in the Twitter London office. The guy who sort of runs Twitter UK, we've got this sort of rule of thumb that if someone's called Dara a dickhead by the end of the week, their first week, it means the culture's in a good place. And you know, it's just a really interesting thing. It happened because, like, about 3 years ago, we had a sales finance guy came in, and at the end of the first week, Dara had taken the piss out of him, and this guy said, "You really are a dick." And we're like, there was a collective cheer because we thought, if someone at the end of the first week is already calling the boss a dick, then it's probably a good sign.
One of the rules I have, we've discussed it on here before, it's not a rule I have because I don't employ anyone anymore, but I would never employ a triathlete because they just spend all their time training. And the problem with a triathlete, sorry all triathletes listening to this, is they never know when to stop, because you can always do, like when you're running, you can, you know, there's only so much running you can do before you exhaust yourself. But then if you can add swimming and cycling to that equation, which sort of brings me to the
that's an interesting one, though, because I saw Chris Hoy talk about the mantra, and like I know a semi-professional cyclist, and she said, you won't believe how lazy we are. Chris Hoy, though, said the mantra of the Team GB cycling team was never stand when you can sit, never sit when you can lie down. And he said, you'll never see a cyclist walking upstairs. So I wonder if there's some difference between people who are professionals.
Definitely.
And, you know, weekend enthusiasts.
The Olympians wear watches so they can, like GPS stuff, so they can make sure they haven't left their houses, because they've got to relax.
Right.
That's all the Olympians are like that. So they've got to do relaxing, whereas an amateur triathlete. But if you read the Brownlee brothers book, my God, they never stop training.
Many laughs in that.
Do you know what?
The best anecdote in that book?
Do you know why? I absolutely love that book.
Okay. And no, shout out to them. I love them,
I tell you why I love that book. Well, no, it's just amazing reading it. I love that book is because they're so obsessed with being the best and not the fame which goes along with it. They're not interested in the fame,
right,
and they find it embarrassing. They've come on my show before, and they enjoyed themselves, but they were quite embarrassed by the whole not embarrassed, but they were sort of slightly anxious about it, I think. But they just love the fact that they're training and they're good and they're brothers together. It's a really good book. I recommend it. But saying that, the interesting thing I've always thought about, if you're something like a cab driver, is, you know, the longer you're out, the more money you earn. When do you stop?
Yeah, that's it.
I couldn't deal with that in my mind.
Yeah. I think that's the hard thing, isn't it? You know, the interesting thing, if you look at the science of working, that it's hard on jobs like that where you've got a really clear connection. But to model that in other jobs is a bad idea. So, you know, the people who've studied the science of the amount of work you should do say you shouldn't do more than 40 hours a week. The end result of working more than 40 hours a week is you're basically just killing a bit of the mojo, right, a bit of the creative spark. So, yeah, if you've got a very sort of routine job that's, you know, you're making cakes, yeah, then by all means sort of make more cakes. But if you've got to come up with clever ideas for recipes, working 80 hours a week is not the secret of success.
Yeah, and I don't have a proper job, but the idea of working on live TV, the reason why I love it is once it's finished, it's finished. Yeah. You can't go back and do it again. Yeah. That's why I really enjoy it.
Joy in that though, isn't there? Being able to switch off not feel like these unfinished threads.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't, let's do another take. Yeah. There's no more takes.
Yeah.
That's it. You've got one take.
Go and read the tweets.
A bit like this. You've got a hashtag. I've got the questions. I've got a few minutes left with you, but I've got the hashtag here that I want you to explain. Love where you work. Are you encouraging people to use that?
You know, what happened with that was that it was sort of an organic thing. And it's a really big Twitter thing. But what happened was I think it was a good reminder of the power of good work culture. We had, when Twitter was like the size of this kitchen, Twitter UK was the size of this kitchen, we had a tiny little team, and we had a Kiwi marketing woman who worked with us. And it was sort of an unfortunate thing where she got quite unwell. And out of nowhere, she got quite unwell. And she was sort of in a hospital, and she was getting treatment for quite an aggressive cancer that had sprung on her out of nowhere. And her fiance said to us, look, guys, can people stop texting her? Can they stop emailing her? Can they stop tweeting her? Because it's overwhelming. She's sitting there, she's trying to deal with sort of really grave consequence of what's happening. And, you know, the need to service those messages is making her unhappy. And so what happened was we were all like, well, what can you do? You can't send sweets or chocolate to someone who's got cancer. The sugars sort of really feeds the cancer. We couldn't send flowers because we were told it was a pollen-free ward. And someone in the office said, why don't we knit a blanket? Now, I don't know what your knitting's like, Tim.
Not good.
Yeah. But all of us sort of, we had like a lunchtime course where we all learned how to knit. And we knitted this... Brilliant. Sort of very characterful blanket. It was like we got dry cleaned. We sent it off to her, and she tweeted, like, first time she tweeted in 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, the pace of her illness was like really, it was sort of dazzling. Like you couldn't quite take it in. But she tweeted this tweet, sort of here with my Twitter blanket, love where you work. And and I think, you know, that moment was just this moment of outpouring where we were all sort of overwhelmed with the joy of seeing someone we loved not well but happy. And so it sort of became this organic thing. So, you know, the funny thing is we have journalists come, we've put it on the wall, actually. We moved offices, we moved from this kitchen size office into a rather nicer office, and we said we're taking Lucy, she passed away unfortunately, and we thought we're taking Lucy with us, we're going to put her hashtag on the wall. And you know, it's very private, it's a sort of Twitter employee thing, but we often have journalists come in and they think it's sort of mind control. They're like, why have you got that on the wall?
Subconsciously.
Yeah, but they say, are you telling people they've grown up where you work? And far from it, it's just a reminder to us that, you know,
Other people picked up on it and started doing it?
You know, all of the other offices have it now. Anytime you go to the hashtag love where you work, you'll normally find there'll be like a few random things around the world, and then there'll be a Twitter person who's made someone else a cup of tea. Or there'll be like really true, you know, someone's done a shop run and come back with chocolate biscuits. You know, there'll be really sort of trivial things on it. But it's an organic thing, really. So it's not a... it's not like a company mandate.
Right.
No one has sent an edict. It's just like an illustration of when work goes well. You feel a bond with the people you work with.
Yeah. All right, I've got questions to ask everybody, so I'll ask them to you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Yeah, my mate always says it all the time. My mate Chris Maples always says this, which I think is an Alan Corran bit of advice that he told his kids. He told his kids that, you know, unless you've got something funny or interesting to say, don't. What right have you got to speak up? And I think, you know, that's I love that bit of advice. It's just, you know, I always think of it. You'll be spared this, Tim. But when you turn up and you have to go to presentations or conferences, and people standing up, not thinking I'm going to make this interesting for everyone else, but more I'm just going to give you a bit of blah 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 about my life. And you know, it's not a bad discipline.
I've thought for 2019, it was one of my sort of ideas, is I would listen more than I speak. I do a lot of talking, far too much, because I was thinking about the art of conversation, and surely if I wanted to learn, which I do, then I should do more listening than speaking, which is what I do on this podcast. I imagine I do more listening than speaking. And when I'm speaking, all I'm doing is virtue signaling or signaling of some description. Maybe it's virtue signaling, but so I should start listening more. So that's a good piece of advice. Maybe I should take it on board myself. What's the biggest mistake you've made?
I was thinking about this when I saw this question. So, I don't want this to be a reflection on the person, but so when we were setting up Twitter's office, we were hiring a stack load of people, and my governor said to me, my governor at the time, didn't work there now, he said to me, you know, you need to hire this person. And we interviewed this guy, and then I didn't think he was right for us. And then about 3 months later, the boss came, I'm going to call this guy Brian. My boss came back to me, and he said, I think time to go back for Brian. And I replied to my boss, Tony, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't give you the reason before, but I think Brian's mediocre and we don't need mediocre around people around here. Press send. And just, you know, like the moment I press send, I noticed that Brian was on copy of the email.
Oh, no.
And the phone I had at the time, I think it was a Samsung phone, but the phone I had at the time, you could rip the battery out. And so, you know, sort of world-class reaction times. I ripped the battery off the phone and I took the SIM card out of the phone. And then so like I plugged the phone back in, turned my Wi-Fi off. So I'm at home at this moment. So the SIM card's out, the Wi-Fi's off. I open, wow, the email is sitting in the outbox of my email. So I delete the email. And then from the deleted items, I clear deleted items, put the SIM card back in, put the battery back in, turn on the Wi-Fi, and I get an email immediately from someone else who was on the email thread saying, shall I phone Brian and tell him that that was a mistake?
What? No.
And it had gone. And basically she said, shall I phone him and tell him? And I thought, if anyone's going to phone him, I've got to phone him. So I picked up the phone. It was more than a little bit upset, I'm not going to lie. But yeah, it's like that danger of...
At least you put it to bed, though.
You know, I think you've got to fess up, haven't you?
Wow. Oh, God, I'm sweating thinking about that.
I know.
Oh, it's horrible.
I know.
Emails.
It's one of those ones, you know, when sometimes out of nowhere you'll be walking down the street and then all of a sudden you'll flinch thinking of...
any life hacks?
I'm not a big fan of life hacks, to be honest with you. I mean, look, you know, big things for me, try and get a bit of a balance with your work. But, you know, the biggest life hack of all is sleeping, you know, like getting more sleep.
Yeah.
And we sort of go through cycles, don't we? When sort of back in the day, people used to celebrate the no sleep movement. And Elon Musk is probably the remaining poster boy for it. And, you know, like not sleeping and working hard. I think, you know, I love... that Matthew Walker book from last year, Why We Sleep. I don't know if you've done that or...
Yeah, no, he hasn't been on, but Mia Krieger has, who's also another sleep expert. And he basically says an adult needs between 7 and 9 hours sleep. Yeah. He's not met an adult yet who can survive on less.
The best part of that is that there are a group of people who say they don't need it.
Yeah.
And so the biggest study, they gathered about 400 of those people, I think. The biggest study, they studied their brain. They wanted to see what's the difference between their brains. 3/4 of the people, when they were loaded into an fMRI scanner, fell asleep while they were having their so they basically said, right, we've realized the difference between a brain that doesn't need sleep and a brain that does is that someone's lying to themselves. They all need sleep.
Yeah, they do. And we discussed the disease.
That's right.
Especially things like dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff, which they're linking to a lack of sleep.
Back in the 80s, Reagan and Thatcher were like
we discussed that with Mick.
Both of them died of degenerative brain diseases.
Yeah, and then we discussed also Donald Trump, the fact that if you don't sleep enough, you start becoming like petulant.
Mm.
And he was often at that stage firing off tweets in the middle of the night, sort of petulant tweets about world leaders or whatever he decides to do, because he had the ability to turn to his phone and pick up Twitter, and there you go, that's all your fault. You've ruined the world, Bruce. You and your mates. No. Okay. Can you recommend a book?
I mean, most recently, I loved. I'd never even heard of this case, but that Bad Blood book. Have you seen that?
No.
Is it like? It's a big seller last year. It was like recommended. I love year end book lists. You know, like whether it's albums or whether it's books. And it's the story of this startup. It's a true life story. It's like ongoing now, of this health startup that was like was claiming to be worth billions of pounds and of dollars. And it was designed to test your blood with a pinprick of your thumb. And they'd created these little boxes that you were going to be able to have at home, and it was all make believe and pretend. But the story of it, I mean, I audiobook loads of things. I think audiobooks are like this revelation. But the story of it reads like a thriller, you know, like it's sort of, you feel like you're in the middle, you are in the middle of a confidence trick, but the anxiety that must run through people who do those
Hold
things.
On, we've got people, yeah, but we've got people doing that stuff for centuries, saying they're mediums, yeah. Psychics, reading the star signs, and
yeah.
We're all falling for it non-stop, constantly.
I love the audacity of those things. I remember reading one, seeing one on TV, of a lad who spent 3 months in a hotel in Liverpool pretending to be a Liverpool trainee. And what I love is he was going out, full kit every day, walking through reception, bouncing a ball.
Oh,
because
brilliant.
That's what you do. Yeah. You turn up with your own football when you're training.
That's funny.
And every day, and basically he said, just invoice the club. Live there for 3 months
brilliant.
In the hotel.
Did Liverpool pay the bill?
I think in the end it got rumbled
right,
because the
okay.
bill turned up. But I can't.
I like that.
I can't quite understand the fear.
I
that
couldn't
was
do that.
Running through you.
The anxiety I'd have doing that would be horrific. Just talking about audiobooks there, have you found, Mark and myself have found that we've not listened to as much music now?
You know, it's dangerous, isn't it?
It's podcasting, audiobooks.
Yeah.
There's so much to listen to and so much, you know, I started down the rabbit hole listening to your podcast the other day, and so I think, oh, I'll read this, I'll listen to this one.
Are you a pod faster? Do you listen to podcasts fast?
No.
1.8 I do.
Do you?
Mate, I'm obsessed with podcasts on American politics. I'm obsessed with it.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's that thing where 20 years ago, you couldn't have consumed the same media that America
yeah.
I start my day every day. I'm not sure this is good for mental health, but at 1.8 speed, I listen to at least an hour and a half of American politics podcasts.
An hour and a
every
half
day.
At 1.8 or that
Imagine
equates...
that, so like 2.5 hours.
Wow, what?
1.8 speed. Anyone who walks into the room when I've got a podcast on fast just winces because you know it's words coming out, but they sound like they're sort of being downloaded at computer speed. But once you get into it, you can't go back. In fact, the best podcast I love is the New York Times Daily. I don't know if you've ever listened to that.
This guy, no, I don't listen to it. No.
This guy called Michael Barbaro. Every day, 15 minutes, he tells you what's happened. If you only want to occasionally to delve into what's happening in America, 15 minutes every day. So 10 minutes for me or 7 minutes for me fast. But when I hear him, and for me, when he's on this podcast, he's like this zinging intellect. His cognition is just mind-blowing. When I hear him on Real, I'm like, come on, Michael.
Speed up, come on.
Here's what I've learned. The direct result of it, there's a woman I love on American TV called Rachel Maddow. When she's on fast, 1.8, she's like really clever. When she's on slow, she sounds really stupid. I've realised you can convince people you're cleverer by talking fast.
Oh.
I'm certain of it. Speaking fast.
You need to get someone to do some research on
yeah.
it, some science on
Speaking
it.
Fast, man.
Speaking fast. Yeah, I try to do it, but it depends who they are, the people on the podcast,
yeah.
because sometimes they go so fast you can't hear them properly, do you think?
Yeah.
And then some people...
Certain people. But Americans do speak slower than Brits as well, I think.
Yeah, probably. Final question then, what's the meaning of life?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, for me, look... Do you subscribe to the computer simulation idea? That
Elon,
we're all living in a simulation?
Elon Musk. Do I subscribe to it? No.
As a percentage, what percentage likelihood do you think it is? I reckon I'm 30.
Well, I quite like Elon, so I'll go 31.
Okay. yeah, so like my overall feeling is just you got to try and optimize for happiness. And I know that seems like a sort of...
Well, no, that's not what he believes, though.
Like, when you're asking me the meaning of life rather than Elon Musk on computer simulations.
Yeah, but he says... I interviewed his wife that he married twice. What's her name? Do you know Mrs. Musk?
I know who you mean. She's an actress, isn't she?
Mrs. Musk, yeah. And she says that you have to do something to get noticed. That's the idea of the game. If you're in a simulation and it's a computer simulation, we have to assume it's a game like The Sims or something, one of those sort of computer games, then you should be doing something to get noticed. So what you really need to be doing is something to be noticed.
I should have given you that as my bit of advice, actually, because, top tip for life. The only way I got my first job, so council estate in Birmingham, you know, like no network. My dad was unwell through the whole of my life, really. And I was working in Birmingham, and I was up. All I wanted to do was work in a record shop, in a record company. All I wanted to do, because I didn't know what jobs, no one knows what jobs there are, right? And I wanted to work in a record company, and I used to send all these letters, and I tried sending them on yellow paper, no response. And I drew a 4-page cartoon CV of my life.
Brilliant.
And I am like a 5 out of 10 artist. But combination of it looked a little bit like me, and I went from no one was responding to any of my letters. You know, I had no reason to work in a record company. So I was getting people having long lunches, phoning me when they got back to the office, people saying, come down and work down here. And so I mentioned I'm going to a school tomorrow, but I always say to the kids, don't underestimate your ability to get noticed by people, because I bet you get zero letters. I get zero letters through the post. So I always say to people, you want to get on the boss of Google's desk? You want to get on the boss of, you know, Channel 4's desk? Send them a hard post and back to the Alan Corrin thing, be interesting or funny. If the advice in the simulation is get noticed, I think there is some truth in that.
Yeah, well, that's how I got noticed, by putting loads of photos over it. I had a massive, huge blonde quiff. Got no hair now, but at the time I had, I ended up working at Planet 24 as a researcher, because they just saw my picture and decided to get me in for an interview. Right. Then when I went in, I just sort of, I charmed them.
Bring back the big breakfast,
with me presenting it, that'd be a good idea. We've run out of time, but have you got just 30 seconds to tell us your CV then? Because I'm fascinated now you've said
So, started 16th birthday working in fast food restaurants. But I went to university. I went to first member of my family to go to university. I went to York University. And again, didn't know what I wanted to do. But I'd been told when I was sort of like 14... background I'd said, I fancy being a lawyer, because you only know the jobs that are on telly, right? And someone and
cop or lawyer,
that's right. and if you consider the amount of criminals on TV, it's amazing that's not regarded as more of a I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. Someone said people like you aren't lawyers, so I had no idea. So I just thought, I want to work on what I'm interested in. So I tried to get a job in a record company. Basically didn't get that, but what I realised was that cartoon, I got offered a job, postboy of Virgin Records. That was my dream. Like, the CV had got me the opportunity.
Brilliant.
And the woman said, so your job, Karen Harries, she said to me, your job is to drive down to Ladbroke Grove post office every day, deliver the sacks of mail. And I said, I haven't got a driving licence, but I'm going to take a crash course, and in 2 weeks I'm going to, if I haven't got my driving test, true life this is, I spent my savings on it. If I haven't got my driving license in 2 weeks, then I will give you back the job. But if I've passed, then I'll do it. And I failed my driving test.
No.
I know, innit? So I failed my driving test. But I knew that car to, when I had to phone her up, it was a really awkward call. And I was saying to someone yesterday, I should have just said, I'll carry the post. But in those days, it was CDs and vinyl, you know. Yeah. There was no... Anyway, I thought, this cartoon CV seems to have some magic to it. And so I used to change the first square of the cartoon CV each time, so it looked like I was applying for their job. And I got a job at Capital Radio. So they said to me, actually, they said, you were by far the worst person we've ever interviewed, but the CV had gone round the office.
Oh, brilliant.
And people were like, how's Cartoon Boy? When's Cartoon Boy coming in? And so that's why I think, you know, don't underestimate.
Yeah.
If you've been interesting or funny, don't underestimate how far that can take you. So I went from there, worked in radio for a bit, eventually worked at Google. And when I worked at Google, you know, I'd joined just after they bought YouTube, and no one wanted to work on YouTube. You won't believe that. 10 years ago now, no one wanted to work on YouTube because there was no money in it. And they said, oh, it's dogs on skateboards. It's like, it's really bad stuff. It's pirate content. I said, I love YouTube. It's like the thing that unites my dad with kids.
Yeah.
And so by working on YouTube, it was a dream job. you know, and it was through there that Twitter contacted me saying, will you come and work at Twitter?
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Well, thank you so much. You never told us the meaning of life, by the way. Was it to get noticed in the simulation?
No, and happiness for me. Just happiness. Like optimized for happiness because this is all a game, isn't it?
It's all a game.
It's all a game.
You're right. Thank you so much for doing
this. Thank you.
The book, The Joy of Work, 30 Ways to Fix Your Work Culture and Fall in Love with Your Job Again, is out by the time. It's out. Yeah. When's it out?
Well, Blue Monday is what I'm saying. It's out next Thursday.
Next Thursday. Okay. And the Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat is your podcast. Well worth a listen. But this book's great. It's got so many intro. It's got 30, in fact, 30 ways that you can improve your work life. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you for the wine.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation with Bruce. Didn't enjoy him talking about sending an email off to...
Oh.
I've done that. I've done it twice. I did it once as a text and once I did...
as a text, yeah.
And I did it once as an email.
Any repercussions?
Yep.
And that was the end of... That was the end of Soccer AM.
No, yeah, both times it was just absolutely mortifying. You just have to own up to it.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Is it a shower moment? You know.
When you think about it now
and again, it comes back.
No, I've been all right about it because it was a long time ago. But
it's come back.
It's just
nice one, Bruce.
Oh, it's horrible when that happens. Oh God. Enjoyed that though, did you? It was thoroughly good. It's nice to talk all about work. We obviously all have to do it, and it's one of those things. So it's good to get some, you know, the science behind it all. And work, I think, is changing dramatically as we speak. We didn't actually get onto it because he had to go off. He's doing promo at the moment, but I wanted to talk to him about AI and how it's going to steal all our jobs. There's another guy, isn't there, venture capitalist, who's said that 40% of our jobs will be gone in, I think he said 10 years, was it? I just remember reading facts and never taking them in, but, you know, so 40...
Are they going to have robotic TV presenters?
No, they've got wooden ones, though, like me.
The Timbot 3000 coming up next.
Tin pot.
Timbot. The Rimatron.
That's it. Timbot 2000.
2000. That's a bit old.
Yeah. So
on the show today we have Johnny Vegas.
Yeah, but he did talk about the simulation thing, which is it's starting to gain a bit of pace.
It's gathering a bit of traction. I mean,
it's kind of
the thing is that you don't want to go, oh, it's absolute bollocks, because it might just turn you off.
Oh, let's delete. So we've got to, you know, get noticed by the people who are playing the game. How do we get noticed? Got to do something, Mark. Got to do something to get noticed. Otherwise, they get rid of us. So
We're trying.
Yeah. The simulation thing. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I'd like to say I don't believe in it, but there is a bit of me. It's like the star signs, which I really don't believe in. But if I read them enough, you start going, well, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's the way in which they're written, aren't they?
Yeah. But anything you go, Loch Ness Monster, you know, obviously the Loch Ness Monster. Well, I say obviously it doesn't exist, but you'd have assumed they found it. But then someone goes, that loch's really deep. Oh, well, it could exist then. Oh, it might do. Bigfoot, you know, it's all those things. You just go, oh, really?
I quite like the idea of Bigfoot.
Do you?
Yeah.
Do you think it exists?
I don't know. I think there could well be. They always go and find different new species of stuff, don't they?
The one I loved the most, which was I listened to a podcast on, was the fact that there was a race of people, not aliens, which were here, which was similar to us, but had developed slightly differently, of human sort of makeup. And they were living here thousands of years ago, before the pyramids, before all that, and they got wiped out. And then the Neanderthal came along later and turned into us. but basically before that there was a whole species of human. That's the one I like. I like going online and just looking at all that rubbish.
What are they called?
Well, we don't know because they probably don't exist, Mark. It's probably just fantasy. But
there's no actual hard evidence. It's just
no.
It's just conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Oh right.
Well, I mean, the people who tell you about it on YouTube say that there's
my absolute favourite conspiracy theories of all are the JFK stuff.
Oh dear, I don't bother doing that. I'd go through alien stuff.
You know, I find that fascinating because there's a heavy argument for the mafia being involved, which I find really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I know. I think I'd love to.
And you would
JFK
never know because they only talk when they walk. Talk when you walk if you're mafia.
What are you talking about?
Mafia. You would never know because they only talk when they walk. That's what we found out just now off Bruce.
Oh right, yeah, sorry. I thought the Tim Pot 3000 had had some sort of simulation breakdown.
Happened years ago. Absolutely years ago. Right, that's it from this week on the Dear Love Joe podcast.
Did we find out the website?
Yes. Thank you, Quooker, for sponsoring. By the way, it's Quooker, Q-U-O-O-K-E-R, but I think it's pronounced Cooker. Quooker, Cooker. It's .co.uk, so Quooker, Q-U-0-0-K-E-R, tap spoiling water. And, you know, they are safe to use. It's tough because everyone always goes, oh, boiling water, what about kids? They've got child safety stuff on them, so you have to be an adult really to use them.
I've worked it out.
Mark has worked it out, yeah, he has worked it out how to use it. Anyway, thank you very much, and we will see you all very shortly. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye!